listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Setting the Stage by Wayne Lawson. In 1965, George Segal burst into stardom with Ship of Fools and King Rat. A year later, he achieved superstardom in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, playing the role Piazza had played on the stage, with Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, and Sandy Dennis, directed by Mike Nichols, all of whom, including Segal, were nominated for Academy Awards. Taylor and Dennis won. In 1967, he got great reviews playing Biff in a TV version of the American classic Death of a Salesman with Lee J. Cobb, the original Willie Loman. After starring in 1970 with Ruth Gordon in the outrageous comedy Where's Papa, he became a favorite romantic leading man, acting opposite some of Hollywood's biggest names, Barbara Streisand, Jane Fonda, Goldie Hawn, Jacqueline Bisset, Natalie Wood, and Glenda Jackson. In the 80s, his career went south, owing to, among other things, drugs. But he came back with a bang in the 90s, playing serious leads in movies and on television. His last triumph was an 8-year run on the Goldbergs, 2013 to 2021. Marion Segal, meanwhile, became a film editor, working most notably on Terrence Malick's Badlands, 1973, and Days of Heaven, 1978. Roy Scheider, after winning an Obie in New York for the play Stephen D. in 1968, became world famous just 3 years later for Clute and The French Connection. He subsequently appeared on TV and in films roughly 100 times, and he achieved international regard for two blockbuster successes, Jaws, 1975, and All That Jazz, 1979. Wayne Rogers was the last to hit the big time, but once he played three seasons of MASH from 1972 to 1975, his red hair and big grin were engraved forever on the public's consciousness. He left the show because he felt the producers were favoring Alan Alda over him. But he soon starred in another comedy series, House Calls, from 1979 to 1982. Besides acting, he made frequent TV appearances as an expert on the stock market, and he was a brilliant money manager, particularly for Falk and himself. At his death, Rogers was reportedly worth $75 million. Though I saw Rogers occasionally in the 70s when he was acting on the East Coast, I never had any contact with the other three once they became stars. After they moved to L.A., their long marriages all ended in divorce. Peter and Alice Falk split up in 1976 after 16 years together, and he remarried 1 year later. Wayne and Mitzi Rogers divorced in 1983, and he married again in 1988. George and Marion Segal ended their 27-year marriage in 1983, and he married twice more. Roy and Cynthia Scheider split in 1986, after 24 years together, and he took a second wife in 1989. Cynthia, like Marion Segal, had become a film editor. All four men had long careers. Scheider died in 2008 at 76 of multiple myeloma. Falk passed in 2011 at 83, a victim of Alzheimer's disease. Rogers died in 2015 at 82 of pneumonia, and Segal in 2021 at 87, after bypass surgery. 6. Back in the 60s, I would have bet the ranch that Ed Heffernan would be the biggest success of them all. He seemed terrific in everything he did, from multiple roles in Shakespeare in the Park to the Fantastics off-Broadway to Pearly on-Broadway, and everyone loved and admired him. But fame can be very fickle. Heffernan was born with the face of a character actor, rubbery and wonderfully expressive, but not at all conventionally good-looking. As a gay man, he struggled to accept himself. Before he died in 2018, at the age of 84, he had been in 42 plays and performed 24 roles in movies or on TV. But the roles got smaller and smaller because he couldn't control his drinking. He was last on the stage in 1987, and he played occasional small parts on TV until 2014. Today, as Google will tell you, he is best remembered as the gang's bank teller in The Sting, 1973. I recently discovered a weird little-known film he's in, Puzzle of a Downfall Child, 1970, starring Faye Dunaway, where his acting in a few short scenes stands out. Scheider is also in the cast. Heffernan was in the original productions of two plays by Albee on Broadway. The second was Malcolm, and he once took me with him to Albee's house in Montauk. The invitation was for tea, which was served by a white-coated butler. But when Albee, who was a recovering alcoholic, asked us if we'd rather have a drink, Heffernan and I both asked for a martini. When the butler came in again with a silver tray, Albee asked, "Does cinnamon toast go with a martini?" Almost in unison, Heffernan and I replied, "Not with this one." I always assumed that Ben Piazza would also rise to the top and stay there, given that he had been in 9 Broadway plays and 3 works by Albee, including The Zoo Story, before he was 40. He called me in 1969 to invite me off Broadway to see 2 short plays he had written, one of them featuring his wife of 2 years, Dolores Dorn Heft, who had previously been married to Franchot Tone. During their 12-year marriage, they would appear together in one film, The Candy Snatchers, 1973. Piazza was in a dozen more films, but mainly in character parts. The best known are Tell Me That You Love Me, Junie Moon, 1970, starring Liza Minnelli. Wayne Tippett is also in it. The Blues Brothers, 1980, where he is the uptight gentleman who asks the head waiter to change his table in order to move away from the scruffy title characters. And Guilty by Suspicion, 1991, about blacklisting in Hollywood, in which he plays the producer Daryl Zanuck. Piazza died of AIDS in 1991 at the age of 58. Minor and Carruthers kept their apartments on 21st Street until they died, Minor of prostate cancer in 1991 at the age of 63, Carruthers of a heart attack 4 years later when he was 64. Minor was the wittiest and probably the most intelligent of the actors I knew. For example, in preparing to play Uncle Vanya for a very brief run in a regional theater, he looked up every word of the text in an English-Russian dictionary. And for several years, he taught drama at Bennington College. After Jason Robards, a friend from their circle in the Square days, married Lauren Bacall, he invited Minor to their apartment in the Dakota for drinks. In response, Minor invited the couple to dinner on 21st Street. "It happened to be a sweltering evening," Minor recalled, "and Jason and Betty had to pass the super and his wife, who were cooling off on the stoop, and climb 5 flights of stairs before they got to the hot meal he had spent 2 days making." As Minor grew older, he directed mainly in regional theaters, where over the years he worked with some major stars, including Geraldine Page, Rip Torn, Sandy Dennis, Gene Marsh, and Wayne Rogers. In 1982, Rogers arranged for him to direct an episode of House Calls, Minor's only job in TV. Carruthers, too, acted mainly in regional theaters, but he also had small parts in films, including Tootsie, 1982. He's the white-haired man who late in the film dances past Dustin Hoffman in drag in a restaurant and tells her she's even better looking in person than on TV. For a number of years, he supplemented his earnings by working at the Virginia Zabriskie Gallery. One of Zabriskie's artists, Robert De Niro Sr., the actor's father, fell for Carruthers and asked him to move to Europe with him. Carruthers had two large portraits of himself by the artist hanging in his apartment, and he often said jokingly, "If I had played my cards right today, I would be Robert De Niro's stepmother." Quintero directed almost 100 productions before he died in 1999 of throat cancer. Of those, 19 were plays by O'Neill, including More Stately Mansions, 1967, with Ingrid Bergman and Colleen Dewhurst, and revivals of A Moon for the Misbegotten, 1973, and Long Day's Journey into Night, 1988, both with Dewhurst and Jason Robards. His early success was increasingly threatened by his alcoholism. In 1968, during rehearsals for a production in Mexico City, the star Dolores del Rio had him fired for drunkenness. After conquering his addiction, he won a Tony for A Moon for the Misbegotten and continued to direct, teach, and lecture for 25 years. Isabel Halliburton, after leaving Quintero, became a casting director, first for Alan Pakula and then for Robert Redford. On films including To Kill a Mockingbird and All the President's Men. Through her, I met scores of actors and writers, had cocktails in the Redfords' apartment, had drinks with Pakula the night after he proposed to Hope Lang, shared a house one summer in the Hamptons, where Halliburton, who looked like Garbo, knew everyone, from the agent Bodie Boatwright to the actor David Doyle, the assigner of assignments for Charlie's Angels on TV. Halliburton spent her last decade in a nursing facility, like Falk, a victim of Alzheimer's. 7. I never wrote the plays I left Princeton to write. I obviously didn't have the talent or the drive, and I soon became totally involved in publishing, where I continued to meet celebrities, but not fledgling ones. Working with me on an encyclopedia at Grolier, for instance, was a young man named J.J. Mitchell, who turned out to be the last lover of the poet Frank O'Hara. Together, I soon learned, they knew almost every painter and musician in New York. I remember one night J.J. invited me to go with him to a cocktail party he said would be fun. Within an hour there, I met Aaron Copland, Virgil Thompson, Leonard Bernstein, Ned Roram, Thomas Shippers, and the great ballet critic Edwin Denby. Later, in my 3 decades at Vanity Fair, I would edit many famous individuals, from Mikhail Baryshnikov to Gloria Vanderbilt, from Hunter S. Thompson to Barbara Walters, and meet many more, particularly at our Oscar parties. But I never again knew celebrities as friends before they became celebrities. And those are the ones I remember with special fondness. I even collect DVDs of films they are in, just to keep them fixed in my memory. One of my favorite recollections from that time is a story Marion Siegel told about fame and the changes it can bring. When I met George and Marion, they lived in a low-rent apartment on Barrow Street in the Village. Ted Mann, Quintero's partner at Circle in the Square, and his wife, Patricia Brooks, a lyric soprano at the New York City Opera, lived in the same building. Shortly after their first son was born, Mann asked the Siegels if they would babysit some evening so that he and Brooks could have a peaceful night out alone together. The Siegels seized the opportunity. The holidays were around the corner, so they got a little fur pelt, posed the child on it, and snapped pictures of him. They put the best one in a modest oval frame and gave it to Brooks and Mann for Christmas. Several weeks later, Quintero gave a large party in his penthouse. George and Marion, who were still pretty low in the pecking order, were among the guests, and when they arrived, Quintero made a big fuss over them. Before they could even get a drink, he said he wanted to show them something. Leading them to a room in the back of the apartment, he pointed to what he said was his favorite Christmas present that year, the picture of the man's baby in the oval frame. Roughly 8 years passed. Thin Man was in Los Angeles with one of the 250 shows he would produce and or direct at the new Uptown Circle in the Square in New York, with which Quintero was no longer affiliated. He happened to run into George, who by then was a big star. Man said how often he thought of the good times they had had when they were all starting out, and how much he missed the old gang. George said he and Marion were having a party at their house that night and gave him the address. When Mann arrived, the house was wall-to-wall with movie stars. As he wandered around looking the place over, he suddenly came across his hostess. "It's so great to see you, Marion," he exclaimed. "I was saying to George this morning how much I missed those old days in the village. We used to have so much fun, remember? Tell me, why haven't we stayed in touch?" Marion took him right back to Barrow Street with her immediate response. "You kissed the wrong ass, Ted," she told him.
Thank you.
beyond a boundary. With sped-up matches and a bevy of big-money backers, cricket is pitching an American resurgence by Craig Cohen. Opening illustration, Major League Cricket's investors hope international stars like Dwayne Bravo, West Indies, Harris Ralph, Pakistan, and Faf du Plessis, South Africa, can score in the U.S. Last time cricket dominated American sporting culture, cholera was booming. Millard Fillmore was our nation's most famous person, and trad wives were known, I'm guessing, just as wives. Since then, cricket has gone bananas, most everywhere else. Said to have originated as a children's game in medieval England, it currently ranks as the second most popular sport in the world, after soccer, with an estimated fan base of roughly 2.5 billion people. It's almost a religion in South Asia, especially India, and also caters to massive crowds in Australia, South Africa, the UK, and elsewhere. Here in the U.S., meanwhile, a typical sports fan can tell you, at the absolute most, two things about the game: that matches can last up to 5 days, and that even then, they can still end in a tie. Now, a coterie of big-money backers, including Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, Adobe CEO Shantanu Narayen, and Access Healthcare Chairman Anurag Jain, are looking to change that. All three have invested in Major League Cricket, the U.S. Men's Pro League that launched with 6 teams last summer. An additional stateside boost is expected this June when the International Cricket Council hosts the biennial Men's T20 World Cup in the U.S. and the West Indies. Then, in 2028, cricket will make its first Olympic appearance since 1900 at the Summer Games in Los Angeles. To understand why cricket appears on the cusp of a comeback in the United States, long after George Washington is said to have taken a few swings at Valley Forge, we should look at why it disappeared. With shorter games and less equipment, baseball surpassed cricket as a way for Civil War soldiers to pass their downtime. After Lee surrendered at Appomattox, those men returned to their hometowns and evangelized what would become known as America's pastime. In today's age of constant stimulation and compressed attention spans, Major League Baseball is fighting its own battle for relevance. New rules introduced before the 2023 season aim to speed up play and appeal to younger fans. But a full 2 decades before the pitch clock, cricket responded to dwindling crowds by inventing an entirely new format known as 2020, or T20, promising an action-packed 3-hour competition in which ties are almost unheard of. T20 reinvigorated cricket interest around the globe. The upcoming men's T20 World Cup might just break international viewership records, and domestic audiences appear suitably intrigued. Tickets to the sold-out match between India and Pakistan on June 9th in New York have been selling on StubHub for upwards of $5,000. And the listener should realize this article went to press many months ago. After a new world champion is crowned a few weeks later in Barbados, many of the game's top international players, including South Africa's Faf du Plessis, Pakistan's Harris Ralph, and Afghanistan's Rashid Khan, will stick around for Season 2 of Major League Cricket. In the league's inaugural season, MI New York, an affiliate of the Indian Premier League's Mumbai Indians, defeated the Seattle Orcas in the championship match before a capacity crowd at Grand Prairie Stadium outside Dallas. This newly renovated cricket-specific facility, home to the Texas Super Kings, seats 7,200 spectators and meets the highest levels of international accreditation. But it's one of only 2 venues that hosted matches in Major League Cricket's first season. The second, a temporary stadium located in Morrisville, North Carolina, hundreds of miles from the nearest MLC franchise. The remaining three clubs are based in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and D.C. As the shortage of playing grounds suggests, Major League Cricket faces considerable headwinds. A grueling international cricket calendar forces MLC to fight for talent as the sport moves its best players around the globe and among the top leagues. To make matters worse, its multi-week season conflicts directly with England's professional season. While stars of the Indian Premier League, the sport's preeminent pro league, are forbidden from moonlighting on other T20 circuits. And then there's the challenge of luring American viewers, virtually all of whom are uninitiated in the ways of wickets and whites, away from the more familiar pleasures of Major League Baseball, Wimbledon, and the Tour de France. If Major League Cricket sounds like a moonshot, however, you're looking at only half the picture. The league exists thanks to the fanaticism and efforts of 20 big-brained and deep-pocketed investors, a who's who of business executives, tech entrepreneurs, and venture capitalists. These guys are all in. From former CTO of Dropbox, Aditya Agarwal, to Perot Group Chairman Ross Perot Jr., it's a group you'd be unwise to bet against. Those who grew up abroad have approached this project with a love for the sport they've had since childhood, and with resources they mostly have not. Major League Cricket has untold potential, says Asair Malik, an aficionado who has worked with the Pakistan Cricket Board and even launched his own line of cricket gear. The challenge is at the grassroots level. Better facilities are needed to improve both the quality and quantity of cricketers in the country. A lot of work needs to be done, but the potential reward is massive. Earlier attempts to launch an American professional cricket league had run aground, but Anurag Jain, co-owner of the Texas Super Kings, became convinced that success was possible after a former classmate launched Willow TV, a pay channel that airs cricket 24/7 in 2010. The U.S. soon became the channel's fourth largest audience base, ahead of cricket-centric countries like New Zealand. When Jain approached his business partner Perot with an idea to bring cricket to Dallas, Perot replied simply, "Of course." Without understanding the game's intricacies, Perot understood its power. While working in India in the 90s, Perot discovered that whenever there was a big cricket game, my Indian colleagues would disappear and I couldn't find them. Soon enough, these two helped form a consortium of cricket impresarios that raised $120 million to launch Major League Cricket. How did the first season go? All Texas Super Kings matches sold out, converting new cricket fans around the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex with every hit six. The playoff crowd was standing room only. By the time MI New York were crowned champions, tens of thousands of supporters had sweated it out in the July heat of Grand Prairie, Texas, to catch the action live. Another 500,000 followed along on social media, and 90 million households tuned in around the world. On July 25th, a tumbling catch by Texas's Mitchell Santner snagged the top spot on SportsCenter's Plays of the Day, an honor more often reserved for a grand slam or a water-skiing squirrel. In a nation of immigrants, perhaps it's inevitable that international sports eventually find their way into our collective consciousness. I started playing soccer in Texas in the 60s. No one knew soccer in Texas, Perot points out. I look at cricket like I look at soccer. Fast forward 40 years, and we'll see how big this can be. For a more recent example, consider the sudden rise of Formula One. During the first round of Biden versus Trump, F1 was barely a blip on our sporting radar. Today, thanks in large part to Netflix's Drive to Survive, Tour stops in cities like Austin, Miami, and Las Vegas have become the hottest ticket in town. America has been called a land of second chances, and cricket has thrived within our borders once before. Can it happen again? There's reason for hope. And to support the cause come November, I'll write in Millard Fillmore. War in Ukraine, justice without borders. Inside the effort to prosecute Russians for Ukraine war crimes. In Argentina, by Janine DiGiovanni. Opening illustration by Dino Suote shows a man standing with lightning striking in the background around his head, or perhaps those are missiles, and with a building that is crumbling superimposed on his body. The American peace advocate Norman Cousins once said, "Death is not the greatest loss in life. The greatest loss is what dies inside of us while we live." The quote has often been linked to Ariel Dorfman's profoundly moving play, Death and the Maiden. Therein, a middle-class Chilean woman who is a trauma survivor, having been subjected to torture and other unspeakable torments, confronts the man who had terrorized her years earlier during her country's brutal dictatorship. "For decades, I have documented torture and war crimes, first as a journalist for Vanity Fair, and now as executive director of the Reckoning Project, TRP, an organization that gathers evidence of the systematic horrors Ukrainians have endured since Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022. When survivors tell me how they managed to bear it all, a common description I have heard is that they had to kill something deep in their psyches. How can these survivors ever hope to heal? One way, which is the main mission of TRP, is to ensure that some of those who have committed war crimes are held accountable in court. If authoritarian leaders remain in power, as in Argentina in the 1970s and 80s, and in Russia today, accountability is impossible. The question then becomes how to create a legal framework so these victims and crimes don't go unnoticed. One method gaining traction in this regard utilizes a principle known as universal jurisdiction, which allows laws to be applied to serious crimes in territories outside conflict zones. In many ways, this is justice without borders. Consider the ongoing war in Syria. 2 years ago in Koblenz, a nondescript town on the Rhine, a verdict was handed down by a German court in the world's first criminal case involving state-sponsored torture in Syria. Anwar Raslan, a senior Syrian official, was convicted of aiding and abetting crimes against humanity and sentenced to life. It was a decisive moment in Bashar al-Assad's war, one in which civilians have been starved, gassed, or treated unspeakably. A case against Rifat al-Assad, an uncle of the Syrian president, for war crimes and crimes against humanity allegedly committed in 1982 will soon begin in Switzerland. In the past, most war crime victims have had no legal recourse. Civilian survivors of the Bosnian War of the 1990s, for example, knew they would die without ever seeing justice served. They just had to continue on, traumatized. I covered that conflict extensively, and one particular story still haunts me. I met a woman who had been held in the rape camps of Foukaa. When the war ended and she returned to her village, she had to see her rapist every day. She told me that with each encounter, she was the one who dropped her eyes in shame. And so the idea that her rapist might never be held to account was particularly cruel. The International Criminal Court and special tribunals, such as the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, established in 1993, work notoriously slow. Notoriously slowly. Few atrocities reach the docket. In the case of the Rwandan genocide, in which at least 800,000 people were killed in the 1990s, I was told by a prosecutor that it would take 40 years to try all of those who were guilty. But these things began to shift with the Koblenz initiative. Perpetrators of heinous crimes could now be investigated, in some cases prosecuted, in foreign countries. Ukraine took notice. The level of criminality inflicted on the country's citizens has been so vast, Prosecutor General Andrei Kostin's office has identified more than 120,000 incidents. The TRP's legal experts began to consider where outside Ukraine or Russia they might plan trials against the transgressors. Since the war began, TRP has gathered more than 300 testimonies from victims of crimes that occurred in Ukraine. In April, thanks to key stakeholders in Argentina and Ukraine, the first universal jurisdiction complaint against members of Vladimir Putin's military and its affiliates was filed in Buenos Aires. The initial case presents charges based on the testimony of one key survivor and loads of supplemental evidence, accusing occupying soldiers of committing thousands of acts of extreme torture. Why Argentina? Partly because of that country's painful past. During the so-called Dirty War of 1976 to 1983, some 30,000 Argentinians were kidnapped, tortured, and killed. One method of torture involved electrocution, also allegedly used by Russians against Ukrainian captives. Thousands of Argentinians disappeared. Political prisoners were also pushed out of planes into the Atlantic. Today, a kind of solidarity has emerged between Ukraine and Argentina. Not only have the country's lawyers and prosecutors shared harrowing stories, but on Ukraine's battlefields, Argentinian forensic teams have been working closely with their Ukrainian counterparts to identify remains and determine causes of death. For Ukrainian prosecutors, as well as for attorneys and investigators from TRP, many vectors have lined up for using universal jurisdiction as a mechanism for legal resolution. The Syrian and Iraq war crimes expert Raji Abdul Salam, who is TRP's chief data scientist in Ukraine, helped build the first Koblenz case. TRP's chief legal counsel, Ibrahim Olabi, is a Syrian-British barrister whose work at The Hague has focused on Syrian chemical gas attacks. Argentina, meanwhile, has spent years trying defendants accused of torture. Moreover, Argentina's prosecutors have opened investigations involving alleged human rights abuses committed by Saudi Arabia against Yemeni civilians, by China in its repression of members of the Uyghur people, and by the Myanmar regime against Rohingya Muslims. Prep work for the Ukrainian case has been laborious. Investigators and legal analysts pored over witnesses and victims' testimonies and the corroborating evidence. Next, teams determined which victims of each complaint would be most credible and whether they could fly to Buenos Aires to testify. Then came a review process with TRP's barrister Jack Sproson, who examined summaries of 170 horrifying testimonies. Sproson narrowed his target sample from 50 witnesses to 20 to 5, in search of one central accuser who might provide substantive leads on perpetrators, taking into account the threshold needed to establish purported crimes fitting the legal definition of torture. At TRP's office in Kyiv, Sproson listened to their traumatic stories. Each gave compelling testimony that was consistent and reliable. Eventually, he homed in on a single witness, whom I will call Mr. M, based on the evidentiary strength of his case and his testimony having the strongest possibility of leading authorities to single out those who committed the crimes. In Mr. M's complaint, he was able to identify key persons, organizations, locations, and telltale insignia on his assailant's clothing. At the same time, another TRP lawyer, Oxford University legal scholar Svetlina Van Bentham, flew to Buenos Aires to begin the groundwork for the case, meeting government officials, legal officers, and others. Accompanying her was Ukrainian journalist Natalia Guminyak, part of TRP's media team, who briefed the Argentinian press and highlighted Ukraine's struggle against Russia. Now, the Ukrainian team and Argentinian prosecutors are opening their investigation, hoping to pinpoint those who allegedly ran the torture facility where the main witness was held captive. Mr. M's statement is agonizing to read. He says he was repeatedly electrocuted, then strangled, in what his captors referred to as calling Lenin, or calling Putin. "I saw lightning," he noted. "Tears and saliva started to come out. I fainted and had to be propped up. Then they found a military baseball hat, put it on me, I think for fun, and said, 'Now we again call Lenin.'" He described his torturers in great detail. It is unlikely that those who savaged Mr. M will ever be brought before a court of law, but in absentia, their acts and names will be revealed. When he was released, Mr. M said he had a profound sense of disappointment in humanity. "I had never seen anyone behave like that. I saw the worst of human beings." This raises two fundamental questions. Why do people resort to such brutality in wartime? And what can be done to help alleviate the lingering agony of those who survive that brutality? 30 years and 18 wars later, I still haven't answered the first question. But I am beginning to see how the pain of victims can be minimally assuaged. Is universal jurisdiction a perfect form of justice? No. But it is a path forward, a crucial step by which survivors can envision a form of redress.
Thank you.
Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Gene Smart. The Emmy winner and star of Hacks on Witchy Bloodlines, Jane Goodall, and the importance of good lighting. Who are your heroes in real life? First responders. One of my younger brothers and his girlfriend are both retired firefighters. I hear their stories, and it's really humbling and moving. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Chastity! Ha ha ha! Which historical figure do you most identify with? My 8 times maternal great-grandmother. She was arrested in Salem, Massachusetts in 1692 and charged with witchcraft, but missed being hanged by one day because she confessed. Her name is Dorcas Hoar, spelled H-O-A-R, an unfortunate name. She was very brave. You can look her up on Wikipedia. What is your most marked characteristic? People tell me it's my laugh. I love to laugh. What is your idea of perfect happiness? My kids are in the house. I've been gardening in my vegetable garden. I have absolutely zero obligations or calls to return. Now I'm fixing dinner with music playing and having a glass of wine. What is your current state of mind? Chaotic. What is your most treasured possession, other than my children, my new house? What is your greatest fear? Losing a loved one. Which living person do you most admire? Jane Goodall. I got the chance to meet her a few years ago, and it was the thrill of a lifetime. When I was little, I wanted to be her. I thought she had the coolest life in the world. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? When I'm feeling lazy and I sleep in too much. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Cruelty, and also general rudeness and unkindness. I've always told my children, don't ever find entertainment in someone else's discomfort. What is your greatest extravagance? Perfume, and going out to dinner. What is your favorite journey? The British Isles. My dad was first generation Scottish. I've been to Scotland a couple of times and met some relatives. I also love Ireland and Wales. They are just so beautiful and the people are so friendly. What do you dislike most about your appearance? I wish I had a really fabulous head of long hair. Which living person do you most despise? Well, despise is a very harsh word, but the closest to that would be Donald Trump. He's done so much harm to our country, and much of it is irreparable, I fear. Where and when were you happiest? My wedding day, and when my children were first placed in my arms. Which talent would you most like to have? Being an incredible dancer, I wish I'd pursued singing and dancing more, especially dancing. It might be a little late now. What do you most value in your friends? Kindness and laughter. If someone makes me laugh, I'm halfway in love. Who are your favorite writers? A few are John Irving, David Sedaris, David McCullough, and Amy Tan. How would you like to die? In a really comfy bed, very, very old, but still very much aware, with my loved ones near me, and good lighting. What is your motto? Find humor in everything. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Gene Smart. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.